You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we head to Karachi as schools shut their doors in protest and Pakistanis across the country hold vigils to pray for the 14-year-old girl who was shot by a Taliban gunman. We look at how the women of Pakistan have reacted to the attack. Anne Applebaum, author of a brilliant new book on the Iron Curtain, explains how communism took hold in Eastern Europe quite so quickly and so comprehensively.
They believed very much in the power of propaganda. If we can just tell people what we're doing and we can convince them, and if we dominate the airwaves, then people will sooner or later believe that everything we say is true.
We catch up with bike guru Michael Colville Anderson to hear how good bike lanes can make or break a city.
100 years of traffic engineering, the one thing, and really the only thing we've learned in a century, is that if you create more space for cars, more cars appear. That's all. That's what we've spent money on for 100 years, to learn that one thing.
And we'll be joined in the studio for a special discussion with two of the finalists of this year's Rory Peck Awards, the event which celebrates news-gathering journalists. All that, plus we might play you a little bit of music too. All to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But before any of that, let's catch up on the news headlines from around the world with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Bill Bingham. Turkey's Prime Minister says a Syrian-bound plane intercepted by Turkey was carrying Russian-made equipment destined for Syria's defence ministry. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says passenger aircraft cannot carry ammunition and defence equipment, and there was such equipment on board. Turkish jets forced the plane on its way to Syria from Moscow to land in Ankara. Syria and Russia deny the plane was carrying illegal cargo and have accused Turkey of putting lives in danger. Striking miners at the world's biggest platinum producer, Amplats, in South Africa, have set fire to a minibus taxi, killing one man. Police say striking miners attacked the taxi that was said to have been transporting non-striking workers. Another man's reported shot and in a critical condition in hospital. South African President Jacob Zuma has defended the right to demonstrate and strike, but he's condemned the violence.
The culture of violence in strikes and demonstrations does not tally with our principles of democracy. The right to demonstrate and strike is a respected right, is enshrined in our constitution. If we exercise that right, we must not undermine the rights of others in the process of exercising our right.
French police have foiled a plot that could have set in motion the biggest bomb attack since the 1990s. Forensics experts believe bomb-making material discovered in a garage east of Paris was sufficient to make an explosive device like the lethal one planted on a packed Paris train in 1995. The Pakistani schoolgirl, fighting for her life after being shot by Taliban gunmen, has been transferred to a specialist hospital in the army garrison town of Rawalpindi. Malala Yousafzai is in a critical condition 2 days after being attacked in the northwestern Swat Valley. The Taliban, who've accused the 14-year-old activist of promoting secularism, say they'll target her again. Pakistani surgeon Dr. Junaid says they're pleased with her progress after having a bullet removed from her head.
Our colleagues, critical care specialists who have suggested that if we shift this patient to critical care unit in a pediatric unit, which is there very well equipped at Armed Forces Institute of Cardiology, that may help her.
The ratings agency Standard & Poor's has cut Spain's credit rating from BBB+ to BBB-, just one level above junk status. S&P have also warned that Spain could be downgraded even further as it struggles with high debt levels and the worst rate of unemployment in the Eurozone. There are expectations in financial markets that Madrid will go the way of Greece and have to request a government bailout despite a Eurozone fund of 100 billion euros to recapitalise its banks. US Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who's in Tokyo for the IMF and World Bank meeting, says America would support a Spanish bailout.
The fund's, been very active, very supportive with the full support of the United States in this context, doing exceptional things it's never done before. And, you know, if Europe thinks that would be helpful in the future in that context, and the terms make sense to the fund, we'll be very supportive of that.
The director of the Massachusetts Bureau of Healthcare Safety says she and federal officials have launched a thorough investigation into the cause of an outbreak of fungal meningitis. The outbreak has been linked to batches of steroids produced by a Massachusetts company. 137 cases have now been reported in 11 states, and 12 people have died. A new report by Amnesty International says local government debt in China is leading to the violent forced eviction of thousands of people. Amnesty's 85-page report, compiled between February 2010 and January 2012, said violence exerted on residents also resulted in deaths, imprisonment, and self-immolations. The oil giant Royal Dutch Shell has been taken to court by Friends of the Earth and four Nigerian fishermen and farmers. They want Shell and other corporations to be held responsible for pollution in the Niger Delta, caused by three oil spills between 2004 and 2005. Egypt has reopened one of its great pyramids to help revive a tourism industry hit by last year's uprising. Antiquities Minister Mohamed Ibrahim reopened the Pyramid of Chefren and six ancient tombs at Giza after a long restoration project. He insisted Egypt is a safe country for tourists. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. It is 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 here in London, 10:06 if you're just waking up in San Francisco. Well, they really shouldn't be waking up at 10:06, but there you are. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Od London, tu vas Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London,
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Monocle 24.
And you're with Midori House live from Studio One here in London. The attempted assassination of a 14-year-old activist Malala Yousafzai earlier this week shocked the world. Malala was singled out by a Taliban militant and gunned down on a school bus in Pakistan's northwestern Swat Valley. She had been accused of promoting secularism by campaigning for girls' education on her blog. Pakistan is a country that is battling with extremism, but it's rare to see outright protests in favour of liberal values. Yet today, in the southern city of Karachi, women came out in force to show support for Malala's cause. Protesters lit candles and tied bands around their arms and heads, inscribed with the slogan, "I am Malala." So what does this show of support mean, however small? Joining me on the line now from Karachi is the journalist Samira Shackle. Samira, thank you very much for joining us today. We often see big protests in Pakistan against US drones or against poorly made film trailers, rarely against violence towards women. Is this a step in the right direction, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely is. And I think some of the more optimistic commentators are saying that, you know, perhaps this is the moment when the public very decisively turns against extremism. Maybe this is the sort of end of the road for the Taliban. I think that's probably slightly over-optimistic, but it's certainly a step very much in the right direction. And I think particularly we've seen here politicians being very equivocal in their approach to extremism. So they're sort of failing to outright condemn the Taliban. You've got certain people within parties saying that there should be negotiations for peace, so on. But I think the sheer scale of the national revulsion at this incident has meant that politicians completely across the board have been united in condemning extremism, talking about looking seriously at the need to sort of eliminate this threat. And whether that's transformed into action remains to be seen.
I mean, Karachi is, you know, arguably the most liberal city within Pakistan. Have there been protests or much outrage elsewhere in the country, in more conservative parts?
Yeah, there have, actually. There's been, in Karachi, there's been a range of things. There's been, there was a procession of schoolgirls protesting, there was a group of women, but we've actually seen it in all the big cities, in Islamabad, Lahore, all over, even actually in Peshawar, which is one of the far more conservative cities. That's the city that's closest to this northwestern province. And there's been a big protest in Malala's home city of Mingora as well, which is right within the Swat Valley. So I think that in itself is quite a big statement, given that, you know, one of the motivations of this attack is arguably to sort of quell dissent that people are still coming out onto the streets in that area.
Now, Imran Khan, leading opposition leader, has said he's going to go to Peshawar to see Malala. Have the government really come out against what happened? Has Asif Ali Zardari, Pakistan's president, made any suggestions that he, that he condemns the attack and that he wants to see them brought to justice?
Yes. Every major politician has not only condemned the attack, but also, I think there's been multiple offers from Imran Khan, Nawaz Sharif, Asif Ali Zardari to pay for her medical treatment and stuff. I think they're all sort of vying to get that ground. The head of the local province has also put out a big reward for the attackers to be brought to justice. So I think that everyone across the board has been condemning the attack. There were prayers in the National Assembly for Malala, but I mean, again, I think there's a level of skepticism about what's actually going to happen, because even after the military offensive in Swat, you have, in 2009, you have many of the key Taliban commanders still at large 3 years after that military operation supposedly dismantled the network. So whether someone's actually going to be arrested, despite all the rhetoric, sort of remains to be seen. I think there's a fair amount of cynicism, it's fair to say, about politicians in Pakistan generally.
Now, Malala remains in intensive care in Peshawar, and it's understood the next 24 to 48 hours will be fairly crucial to her survival. If she is able to go home, what sort of security is she going to need? Is she going to be able to lead anything approaching a normal life again?
It's quite difficult to imagine that she could, actually. I mean, personally, I don't really see how she can continue to live in Pakistan, really, just which is a sad fact. But I think security is, I mean, the fact that this was able to happen, such a blatant attack in an area that's so heavily fortified by the military, is quite a bold statement in itself. And I mean, the military had actually offered security to the family, and her father had turned it down because he thought because she'd been put on the hit list at the beginning of the year, but his thinking was that it would draw more attention to the family. So I don't really know if security is going to work, particularly when, if you look at the assassination of Salman Taseer, who was a minister who was shot for his support of blasphemy laws in late 2011. He was actually shot by his bodyguard. So, you know, there's big risk, especially if, you know, the security is drawn from the local area where people might be sympathisers. The Taliban have already said they'll make another attempt on her life. So I find it quite difficult to envisage that she'd be able to live easily and freely in Pakistan at all. Not in her local area.
Indeed. Samira Shackle in Karachi, thank you very much. We head to Bogota next. You're listening to Midori House. The Colombian government has accused Nicaragua of invading its territorial waters, sending a war vessel near two islands off the West Caribbean coast of Colombia. It's the latest move in an ongoing dispute between the two countries, both of whom claim ownership of the islands. Last year, Colombia took their case to the UN's International Courts of Justice in The Hague. Anastasia Maloney is Monocle's Bogota correspondent, and she joins me now. Anastasia, welcome to Midori House. How serious is this latest move from Nicaragua?
Colombia, in fact, last month, Colombian local press was reporting that the Nicaraguan Navy was doing Navy patrols around the Caribbean coast and going into their waters. So few are thinking that is going to lead to any war or anything serious at the moment.
Can you tell us the latest then with the legal case? Because this has been taken to the UN's International Courts of Justice. Does this, the fact that Nicaragua has made this sort of slightly provocative move, throw a shadow over that process?
The International Court of Justice has actually been looking at this case since 2001, when Nicaragua first brought it to The Hague. The Hague did rule on the islands, there's a couple of islands called San Andrés, Providencia and Santa Catalina, and they rule that, in fact, these were Colombian islands. However, both countries are now waiting for The Hague to make a final decision at the end of this year about the other maritime borders between the two countries. Exactly where does Colombia start and where does Nicaragua stop? And also who owns the other islands in the series of islands in the Caribbean Sea. So both countries are still awaiting the final decisions from The Hague.
And how is this all being received in Colombia? I mean, is there a view that this is just sort of grandstanding by Nicaragua for a domestic audience, or are there any concerns?
I think basically the backdrop to all this is oil. Colombia believes that there is a lot of oil in the Caribbean Sea, and I'm sure that Nicaragua knows about that too. Apparently people are talking about massive oil deposits, and in fact, Colombia has already given exploration license to its state oil company, Spanish oil company, to start offshore drilling. That hasn't started yet because Colombia is waiting for this final decision from The Hague. But many people are saying that it's actually more about oil than about politics.
So in terms of the oil, does Nicaragua have any case whatsoever that some of this might belong to them? Or is there any talk that they might try and do some sort of joint exploration deal?
There's no talk of that at the moment, but some people are saying that in the ruling that The Hague will give at the end of this year, they will give some of the 50,000 square kilometres that they're fighting over to Nicaragua. So Colombia is not expecting to be the owner of all the disputed territory, and Nicaragua could come away with something. Many other Latin American countries are looking at this decision that The Hague is going to make because there are other maritime disputes, for example, between Peru and Chile. And they'll be looking to see whether it's best to solve differences between countries or whether it's worth their while going to The Hague for an international court to decide.
And taking this latest incident in particular, I mean, what happens next? How do you get rid of a war vessel that's in your waters without stoking the fires?
I think what the Colombian government is going to do is simply wait for a decision. I don't think it's going to provoke attack or respond to the latest move. Because at the moment in Colombia, there's far more important issues which there are involved. One of those is the peace talks that's going to start in Oslo next week with the FARC guerrilla members, the FARC guerrilla group. So the Colombian government will be wanting to just ignore this issue for the moment and deal with it once the decision from The Hague has been made.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
This is Midori House live from Studio One with me, Steve Bloomfield. Less than a year after the end of World War II, as Western Europe began its slow recovery, Winston Churchill coined a phrase which graphically described the changes taking place in Eastern Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, he said, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Looking back, what was perhaps most remarkable about the Soviet domination of such great historic countries as Poland, Czechoslovakia and Hungary was the speed with which it took place. Within little over a decade, communism had been fully imposed across half the continent. Anne Applebaum, a writer and historian with long experience of Eastern Europe, has written a new book, The Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe 1944 to 1956. using interviews with former communists and unprecedented access to archives that are beginning to open up across the continent, she discovered just how it happened so quickly and so comprehensively. A little earlier, she came into Midori House to speak to me about the book. There's a big question which you attempt to answer in this book, which is, you know, how was communism imposed quite so quickly and so comprehensively on people who had been relatively free?
Well, they had just recovered from a terrible war, but certainly communism was imposed very quickly and very comprehensively on very different kinds of countries with very wide and very various political and economic backgrounds. These were all countries with long histories of private property. They were all countries with traditions of constitutional government and free press. Of course, during the war, many of them had lost some of these things, but they certainly had a national memory of it. And even more interestingly, some of these were countries that were very anti-communist. Poland had fought the Bolsheviks in the war of 1920, and they had some Poles continued to fight after the war ended. And yet, nevertheless, communism proved to be possible to apply in Poland as well.
And how does that happen in a country like Poland, as you say, which is, it has a lot of private property, it's fought communism before? How does it happen quite so quickly?
Essentially, the Soviet Union arrived with a plan, and it wasn't a careful plan in the sense that we will do this month and we will do the next, but they had a theory of occupation, and they proceeded to carry it out very quickly. And they were basically there were only three or four institutions that they were really interested in. One of them, you'll be delighted to know, was the radio. They believed very much in the power of propaganda. If we can just tell people what we're doing and we can convince them, and if we dominate the airwaves, then people will sooner or later believe that everything we say is true. The other thing, of course, they were very concerned about creating from the very beginning a very powerful and very loyal secret police force. And this was something they actually did before the war. They were beginning to do it before the war, and during the war they worked on it. And when they arrived in 1945 or 1944, when the Red Army arrived, they often had with them the foundation of secret police in each one of these countries. So they had prepared in advance. The third thing that's interesting and maybe more surprising that they cared a good deal about were the elements of what we now call civil society. And this meant everything from chess clubs and sporting clubs to church groups and political parties. And they were especially interested in youth groups. Not even a concept that we think much about these days, but the Boy Scouts, the Young Christian Democrats, the Young Catholics, the Young Protestants. And they were very keen to control these groups, effectively to eliminate them as quickly as possible, because it was in those groups that they saw the foundations of independence. That was one of the things they did very quickly, even before they did anything else.
I'm interested in how you go about researching and writing a book like this about a period of time where most of the people involved, directly involved, are now long gone. And I imagine you've got a lot of primary interviews with people who are in their 70s, 80s, 90s. How much of a challenge is that as a writer to find those stories and draw them out?
It was difficult to find people who are still alive to talk, although surprisingly there are some. There were people in their 70s and 80s who were, they weren't leaders at the time, but they were certainly in these youth movements that I wrote about. And there were some young communists and there were some young opponents of the communists who were able to speak about the period. What I always find in writing is that it's very useful to balance different kinds of sources. So I spoke to as many people as I could. In addition to that, I read memoirs from the period. And in addition to that, I had access to archives. And I worked in archives all across the region. And of course, this is a part of the world where the archives are now fully open, from the Stasi archives in Germany to the secret police archives in Hungary and the Communist Party archives in Poland. You can see everything. And the advantage of archives is they give us really, for the first time, a better understanding of what people in power thought they were doing. You know, what did they say behind closed doors? What were they trying to achieve? And some of it is, of course, very amusing. You know, there's a very wonderful scene that I came upon, a transcript of a meeting of the East German Politburo in the late 1940s, and they're talking about private companies, which still existed at that time, and particularly private shops. Why were these private shops doing so much better than the state shops? And what can we do about it? And somebody suggests, let's shut down the private companies. Then the state shops will work better. And then somebody else says, no, you can't do that. Then people will starve. There will be no food distribution. And they can't figure out, why is it that the theory of communism isn't working in practice? And you can see them arguing about it in the late 40s. And that's the kind of thing you can get from archives now that, you know, we couldn't have seen 10 years ago.
Arguments that some communists were still having 40 years later.
It's amazing. They continued to have many of these arguments over and over and over again. And this problem of the theory of communism telling you that one set of things was going to happen and that in practice it never works out continues to be a problem right up until 1989. It's extraordinary. And the system lurches from crisis to crisis as people try to reinterpret the theory to make it fit reality and to explain why things are happening that really ought not to be happening.
Over the last 20 years, there's been, obviously the archives haven't just opened straight away, there's been a lot of political battles all across Eastern Europe as to how much the archives should be opened, how much should be made public. Have you seen in certain countries that they've been more open than others and that's allowed more understanding of what went on before?
The countries of Central Europe, after an initial argument, which was mostly not so much about government or state archives, but was about people's personal files, should those be open, almost all of them now have systems of access to everything. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's well organized or that it's easy to find things, but in most of them, you can now work fairly freely inside the archives. Once you move further east, it becomes more difficult. The Russians, I've worked for a number of years in Russian archives on a previous book, and since I began working, and that was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, since then, many of these archives have actually closed and documents that were available are now not available. And that's really to do with the Russian rethinking of history, how they want to control their history, how they want to tell their history. In Central Europe, you find that people are generally more open. It's not difficult. It can be tedious to get access to the archives, but it's not politically difficult or controversial.
You mentioned personal files. I remember reading Timothy Garton Ash's book, The File, about the files that were kept, and he discovers that there was one on him himself, not that he was actually allowed to see it at all. Had you come across similar incidents where people have discovered personal files or been made aware that there are personal files which have affected personal history as well, not just the grand geopolitical scale?
Very often. I mean, there are a number of stories. There is somebody I know who discovered that his ex-wife had been an informer, and there have been several people who've found out things that are surprising. Over time, we've come to understand that these files are often misleading in some ways because, of course, it was in the secret police force's interest to mark down everybody as a potential informer. You know, all these people are working for us. And not everybody who'd gone in to speak to them knew that that's how they were being treated. And you have to be very wary about who wrote the file and why were things said in the way that they were. They do not all prove to be completely true. But yes, I mean, the existence of them has changed many people's lives. You know, knowing that things they've done are now available, secrets are no longer secret, has made many relationships different.
You obviously had a good idea of the sort of things you might expect to discover when you started writing this book. But obviously doing so many interviews and looking in so many archives, you obviously found an awful lot of new information. But there must have been certain things that completely surprised you, which changed your way of thinking.
I think I was surprised by something I mentioned a minute ago, the degree to which the ruling powers, the communists in this part of the world, were surprised when their theories didn't work. We tend to think of them as being all very cynical and they couldn't possibly have believed all of this rubbish. But I don't mean to give them some kind of moral credit, but they are constantly surprised when obvious things become clear to them. You know, as I say, when it becomes clear that the private shops work better than the state job, they don't understand it. Why could this be? And that shock and that surprise means that they were even more ideologically blinkered and even more blinded by what they were reading and telling one another than we had come to believe. And that's been very interesting.
And just finally, to bring us up to the present day, although it's very hard to extrapolate across the entire region, do you feel that the more that is being learnt about what happened post-war is affecting the way politics works across Central and Eastern Europe?
I think politicians in Central and Eastern Europe are unusually aware of the dangers of totalitarianism and the dangers of bad propaganda in a way that others might not be so nervous. The other thing I have noticed in recent years is the real interest, and maybe it could be potentially important interest, they're showing in the nations of North Africa and the Arab world. They feel very much that they have experience picking apart these totalitarian and authoritarian regimes, and they have become more interested in being of use in other parts of the world, also in Moldova and Ukraine and the countries to their east. And that's a very interesting new phenomenon that we haven't seen before, is these kinds of countries reaching out to others, helping with democratization or economic liberalization.
That was the author of Iron Curtain, Anne Applebaum. And Alyssa Lurlier, before she came into studio for that interview, Anne found out she'd just been nominated for the National Book Awards in the US alongside Anthony Shadid and Robert Caro. So well done to her for that. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be joined by two of this year's finalists of the Rory Peck Awards, and we'll also catch up with urban mobility expert Michael Colville Anderson to hear how transport has changed in our cities.
Streets, for 7,000 years, were the most democratic of all public domain. You know, they were extensions of our homes, our living rooms, our children played there. And then when urbanisation started kicking off in the late 1800s, early 1900s, things changed rapidly. Cars appeared. And, you know, traffic safety was a massive issue. You know, cars started killing people from day one. And, you know, they continue to do so today. You know, it's amazing how there's no war on traffic fatalities and traffic injuries. So engineering is mathematical models, but streets are human, you know, urban spaces, organic.
That was Michael Colville Anderson. More from him later. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the headlines.
Turkey's prime minister says a Syrian-bound plane intercepted by Turkey was carrying Russian-made equipment destined for Syria's defense ministry. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the passenger aircraft cannot carry ammunition and defense equipment, and there was such equipment on board. Turkish jets forced the plane on its way to Syria from Moscow to land in Ankara. Syria and Russia deny the plane was carrying illegal cargo. Striking miners at the world's biggest platinum producer, Amplat, in South Africa, have set fire to a minibus taxi, killing one man. Police say striking miners attacked the taxi that was said to have been transporting non-striking workers. French police have foiled a plot that could have set in motion the biggest bomb attack since the 1990s. Forensic experts believe bomb-making material discovered in a garage east of Paris was sufficient to make an explosive device like the lethal one planted on a packed Paris train in 1995. The Pakistani schoolgirl, fighting for her life after being shot by Taliban gunmen, has been transferred to a specialist hospital in the army garrison town of Rawalpindi. Malala Yousafzai is in a critical condition 2 days after being attacked in the northwestern Swat Valley. The Taliban, who've accused the 14-year-old activist of promoting secularism, say they'll target her again. The ratings agency Standard & Poor's has cut Spain's credit rating from BBB+ to BBB-, just one level above junk status. S&P have also warned that Spain could be downgraded even further as it struggles with high debt levels and the worst rate of unemployment in the eurozone. The director of the Massachusetts Bureau of Healthcare Safety says she and federal officials have launched a thorough investigation into the cause of an outbreak of fungal meningitis. The outbreak has been linked to batches of steroids produced by a Massachusetts company. Royal Dutch Shell has been taken to court by Friends of the Earth and four Nigerian fishermen and farmers. They want Shell and other corporations to be held responsible for pollution in the Niger Delta, caused by three oil spills between 2004 and 2005. Egypt has reopened one of its great pyramids to help revive a tourism industry hit by last year's uprising. Antiquities Minister Mohammed Ibrahim reopened the Pyramid of Chefren and six ancient tombs at Giza after a long restoration project. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
You're with Midori House here on M24, coming to you live from London. We'll be joined in the studio in a moment by two of this year's finalists at the Rory Peck Awards. But first, let's hear Sophie Delilah from our Midori House session. This is If I Should Die Tonight.
It cries in my heart like it rains in the city. I don't need your help. Don't want your money, 'cause I'm gonna get going and make myself pretty. And now's the time to get down, 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 down. I love the way we move, and we got nothing to lose. Oh, if I should die tonight, I'm gonna end it on the high. Gonna wear that disco light, I'm gonna rock the dance floor. If I should die tonight, I'm gonna live. Get myself down to Disco Town and rock the dance.
That was Sophie Delilah with If I Should Die Tonight. You're with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. There has arguably never been a more dangerous moment to be a freelance journalist. The wars in Libya and Syria have claimed the lives of numerous journalists, many of them freelancers. While staff hacks have the support and backing, both financial and sometimes emotional, of a big media organisation and a supportive editor, freelancers are often sent, or send themselves, to some of the world's most dangerous places with little in the way of backup. The Rory Peck Trust, set up in 1995, is the only organisation dedicated to providing direct, practical support to freelance news gatherers and their families around the world. And every year, the Trust celebrates some of the finest work by freelance cameramen and women with its annual awards. This year, the finalists include reports from Egypt, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and even London. I'm delighted to say that two of the nominees join me in the studio now. Wael Dabous was one of the first journalists to defy the Syrian regime's ban on foreign media, and his report, Undercover Syria, appeared on Channel 4's Unreported World last year. Jason N. Parkinson produced astonishing street-level coverage of the London riots. He was on the streets of Tottenham within hours of the violence breaking out. Wael and Jason, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us.
Wael, let's start with you. Talk to me about how you go to Syria in the first place at a time when it's so dangerous, where there is this ban on foreign journalists, when you don't have a massive budget behind you and the support of an organisation.
Well, as a documentary filmmaker, it's quite a restrictive process. Aiming to go into a country without permission to film as a journalist, you immediately you're forced into the only option of operating undercover. Which for us, I was working with reporter Ramita Navai. We decided that the best option, or really the only option, was to go in as posing as a couple, boyfriend, girlfriend, tourists. When you're used to making documentaries in the open with quite visible camera equipment, you're obviously immediately restricted to working with very small camera. It was at a time when reports were suggesting that anyone even working with mobile phones to film protests was being targeted by snipers. So, immediately it's a different game altogether.
And you're in a situation as well where you're very much on your own, aren't you? If something goes wrong, it's quite difficult to... No one can come in to get you out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a quite a specific scenario for us. You know, I was working with Channel 4 for Unreported World and with Quicksilver Television, both of whom provide a lot of support. You go through various security protocols. So you kind of, you do have very good support in place. But, you know, that as a freelancer, if something does go wrong, it's great to know that you have the safety net of an organisation like the Rory Peck Trust to fall back on.
And Jason, you weren't in an actual war zone as well, but it was at some moments during the violence in the London riots, it was as dangerous. Talk to us about your decision to go and start filming in the first place, because it was very soon after it all kicked off.
Yeah, it was probably within the first half hour. I'd already spotted on Twitter that people were saying there was police car had already been set on fire, and pretty much from that, as myself and my partner, photographer Jess Hurd, were planning to packing our stuff to get out the door, a colleague rang us and said, "We could really do with your expertise down here. We've already seen one photographer being dragged off around the corner. We don't know what's happened to them. There's already about three or four other people injured." So we were pretty much down there by literally scooting our way through the police lines, around the police lines, because they wouldn't let us through. So that led us into the back streets about 10 o'clock in the evening, and managed to get round and navigate within about 20 minutes to go literally 300 or 400 metres with a lot of people trying to stop us, and then obviously negotiating with those people to say, look, we're here to try and get your side of the story. And some people allowed us, some people didn't. One person threw a petrol bomb at us. So that was kind of the beginning of getting in there, really.
And how did it proceed over the coming days? Because obviously this lasted, you know, several days, not just in London but elsewhere in England as well. How and obviously it was incredibly draining as well for those journalists covering it, because a lot of it was overnight. It was continuous. What were your next moves after those initial first hours?
Tottenham literally went on till about I think the last remaining rioters that we saw dispersed about 4 a.m, and we left there about 8 a.m. And the place was—it looked like a lot of people said, it looked like the Blitz in World War II. I've never seen so, even covering Egypt last year, I've never seen so much stuff burnt in one night, and it was absolutely gutted. Over the following nights, we were up in Enfield, and that was just impossible. We couldn't even get out of a car with a camera. Because you would just get attacked. There's people walking down the street with pieces 2x4 with nails in it. And if you had a camera, as several people did, they're immediately attacked, had their stuff stolen. People were beaten up in Hackney. It wasn't as bad in Hackney, but there was kind of a no-go zone, which was Clarence Road. And you just couldn't get up there, especially with the camera. People just didn't want you there. And then the final night, it was actually out in Enfield covering the so-called vigilantes, who, from our experience, seem to be a lot of kind of far-right thinking people. A couple of people I recognise from English Defence League demonstrations in London. So it's those sorts of people as well.
And while looking more generally, I mean, at a time when budgets are being cut across, you know, nearly all news organisations, and there are less staff journalists, staff reporters there. Do you find that more and more, you know, editors are turning to freelancers because it's a bit easier, it's a bit cheaper to get freelancers rather than staff?
I think across the industry in general, it's the way things have been going for quite a while. I mean, personally, it gives me more options. I think it's the same for Jason as well. It gives you more options for people to work for as well, and to make films for, to shoot for. But, you know, the benefit is there. At the same time, there's the negative side, which is that you don't necessarily feel like you've got all the support you want, which is where these other groups come into play.
And Jason, I mean, obviously, you know, both of you are very experienced, but there's been, particularly we saw in Libya, you know, a number of very young freelancers starting out, wanting to, you know, in the same way that everyone did when they started, wanting to have their big break and go to where the news is, but perhaps without hostile environment training courses without, sometimes without flak jackets, which are necessary. Does that worry you that, you know, it seems to be increasing in a way, the number of people who are doing this without that sort of support?
I'm not sure whether it's increasing. There's certainly a steady flow of people, and you can't really blame them for, you know, people want to go out. They've seen it, how people have done it in the past. They go straight into a conflict and they cover it and they make their name from it. In Libya particularly, I think, was a big eye-opener for a lot of people. And even Tim Hetherington had made a statement about a week or so before he died saying, look, there's so many young, inexperienced people out here. They're down the front line. They haven't even got flak jackets. And, you know, people are going to get killed because of this. It does go on. It has been going on. But, you know, certainly in more intense situations, you know, when you're going into full-scale warfare, you can be as experienced as you can be, and you know, all it takes is just one shot or one thing wrong to happen to in order for you to end up being injured or killed.
And with there being more freelancers and, you know, and less staff journalists who will, you know, have the support and will have, you know, the funding from their organisations to pay for training courses and so on, how important do organisations like the Rory Peck Trust then become in terms of, you know, helping those journalists out as they begin?
Well, as far as I know off the top of my head, the Rory Peck Trust can give some really huge reductions to get the people hostile environment training, but also being there just for one thing, to, you know, they sit there and they keep an eye on who's out where and what they're doing, and if people disappear off the radar, they're, you know, one of the first organisations to raise the flag and say, look, we need to find out where these people are. They're the recent, with I believe, two photographers in Ethiopia, who thankfully now have just been freed as well. So, you know, it's good to know that there's people back over here in London and involved with Rory Peck and other organisations like that that are keeping an eye on us.
And Wael, when you look at the work that you did in Syria, do you think it's, and the risks that you're taking doing that, are there ever moments where you think, I'm not entirely sure if this is worth it?
Well, there's a fine line between, you know, a really disastrous situation and just a very good anecdote. And, you know, every step of the way there, you're constantly aware of the risk. And you know that, whereas we were very lucky on the occasion of Undercover Syria, you know, on another day, we might not have been so lucky. You know, we had militiamen outside the safe house in which we were in hiding with wanted men for 3 days. You know, on that occasion, we heard them beating and taking a young man from next door. He wasn't so lucky. We were fortunate on that occasion. So you are aware of the risk every single step of the way. I mean, Jason's obviously been less fortunate on occasions, more fortunate. But I know you've actually we escaped capture. You kind of got close to it, didn't you?
In Egypt, we got basically bundled to the ground by the secret police, and then frog marched off. And bearing in mind, this was several days after Jack Schenker for The Guardian had been captured.
He's also our Cairo correspondent as well.
Is he? Right,
he's,
okay.
Yes. he was put in the back of a van.
Yes, and driven out and then basically run the gauntlet. Not only were they beating people out there, as far as we know, they were taking people out there to execute them as well. So we were very lucky that they just thought they'd taken our material, which they didn't. They took empty cards. And our cards full of all the evidence of what they'd been doing to the people that day was actually stuffed down our underwear. So we got away with that.
It was a good place to put it.
Very good place. There was a few close scrapes out there. So,
indeed. Well, Jason M. Parkinson and Wael Dabous, thank you both for coming in, and best of luck with the awards, which you're going to find out if you won on the 28th of November. So good luck, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Midori House.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's time that cities began to Copenhagenise. So says Michael Colville Andersen, an urban mobility expert from Denmark's capital, who tours the world promoting the Copenhagen Way. His new exhibition includes stunning photographs of cyclists in the Danish capital, alongside state-of-the-art bicycles made by celebrated Danish companies. Fresh from a bike ride with his ambassador and ahead of a talk to UK parliamentarians later tonight, he popped into Midori House a little earlier this afternoon. You're in London to do a number of different talks, mainly about traffic design and how it's failed us all for decades and decades. Explain.
Yeah, well, I mean, I work with re-establishing the bicycle in cities around the world with my company, you know, and advising cities and how they can, you know, achieve the certain levels of cycling that we have in Copenhagen, and like you see in Amsterdam and whatnot. And, you know, I just come to the conclusion, you know, that something's wrong in our cities. And then I investigated what that could be. And I found out that really you can complain about your politicians and your parliamentarians, but it really goes down to traffic design and this traffic engineering mentality that we've had. It's basically stuck in 1935, you know, back when you tried to control our cities and you know, our cities are run by mathematical models and equations, cost-benefit analyses and, you know, impact assessments and all these really boring things, you know. And they're necessary in cities, of course, engineering, but streets for 7,000 years were the most democratic of all public domain. You know, they were extensions of our homes, our living rooms, our children played there. And then when urbanization started kicking off in the late 1800s, early 1900s, things changed rapidly. Cars appeared and, you know, traffic safety was a massive issue. You know, cars started killing people from day one and, you know, they continue to do so today. You know, it's amazing how there's no war on traffic fatalities and traffic injuries. So engineering is mathematical models, but streets are human, you know, urban spaces, organic.
And is the reason why this hasn't changed because the car lobby is so strong, or because it involves us thinking about things a little bit differently and neither us nor our politicians can quite think about things in that way?
I think we've accepted a status quo in our societies that you know, streets are for cars, you know, but for 7,000 years it was a different story. So we've just sort of accepted the status quo. You know, in cities around the world, they can't even put in a cycle track on one single street or widen a sidewalk, create nicer public spaces, traffic calming measures, because it doesn't fit into the computer-generated mathematical model in the engineering department. A lot of ideas die on their doorstep because this doesn't compute for us. So if you look at cities that are really moving forward, you know, and you know, Monocle magazine, of course, has this massive focus on livable cities. It's the ones that are you know, working towards another paradigm shift. We had one when cars appeared, massive paradigm shift towards this perception that streets are for cars and not for people anymore. And now we're slowly, you know, chipping away at that paradigm shift, and we're hopefully, you know, shift it into a new direction, into the, you know, the direction we want to go in. Everybody just wants a nice place to live. And you got cities like Paris and Barcelona. There were no bicycles 5 years ago. And now they're very bicycle-friendly cities, but also with 30-kilometer-an-hour zones. You know, they're taking out expressways along the Seine, the mayor of Paris. You know, we're seeing this change now. And it really is people who have dropped the engineering mentality that, you know, this monkey on our back for a century, and are looking at designing cities, because design can help.
You mentioned two cities that start, Copenhagen and Amsterdam, are cities that have done it, they've done it right and incredibly well over the last you know, several decades. What is it that they've done that other cities like, say, London, like, say, New York, haven't done yet?
Well, Copenhagen and Amsterdam have a parallel story. You know, even before the internet, when, you know, we didn't look at each other so actively as we do now. Massive levels of cycling until the late 40s, and then it started to fall through the 50s and 60s, and we started to recover in the late 70s, and we have reached the levels that we have today of cycling in our cities, but also just generally, you know, the whole livable city equation. And that's because we started thinking bike first and pedestrians first and cars, you know, fourth. Public transport, I guess, would be third. And when you start looking at you prioritizing that way, you see the city differently. When you think car first, as we started to do around the world in the 50s, you know, it's this monster that you create, you know. 100 years of traffic engineering, the one thing, and I mean, really the only thing we've learned in a century, is that if you create more space for cars, more cars appear. That's all. That's what we've spent money on for 100 years to learn that one thing. So these cities and other cities as well, you know, Munich and Zurich and whatnot, you know, they're focusing on public transport, bicycle traffic, pedestrianism, and they're succeeding at it. And the places are becoming, you know, just much more nicer than they have ever been, you know, in their history.
But I mean, if you're on the free market, right, you'll argue that actually, you know, cars have been hugely beneficial to economies all over the West, and that without the car, then you wouldn't have had this economic boom that, well, obviously we're not in the midst of right now, but that many would say we experienced during the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely. I mean, cars have served society in many ways. But what we're seeing is that, you know, the negative aspects of cars are well documented. You know, you have your lobby in America, you know, that sort of more of a right-wing lobby, of course, for, you know, people need cars and they just can't think differently because of the status quo of traffic engineering and the way they were thinking. But, you know, if you look at the densely populated, thriving urban centers of the cities that we love and the cities that work well, you know, like Copenhagen where I live, or my 9-year-old, at the age of 8, he was walking to school by himself. He disappears off to football training. You know, these are the kind of cities we all wish we had, and that's just because we've thought differently about it. And in Copenhagen, it's only 29% of the population who own a car. You know, and this is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. So when you provide people with alternatives, you know, those people will still be productive in the workforce, but you know they're just going to get to work differently and reorganize their lives differently. It's not going to work in a city like Phoenix, this nightmare of urban sprawl, probably the worst example on the planet. But it's going to work in cities around the world. In America, 50% of the population live within 8 kilometers of their workplace. That's a lot of Americans who could be choosing other transport facilities. The same numbers apply in Europe as well.
And just finally, let me ask you about this exhibition, which opens in London later this week. It's a series of photos looking at state-of-the-art bicycles. It celebrates not just Danish bicycle manufacturers, but the idea of cycling, the Copenhagen way. If we go along to this exhibition, what is it we're going to pick up?
The exhibition is showing what is possible in other cities. There's great Danish design bicycles. I rode on a couple of great Danish bicycles with the Danish ambassador today down to Westminster, you know, with our Embassy of Denmark signs on the bikes. It was, you know, bright red bicycles.
The cycle lanes were okay.
They were there some of the time, but otherwise we were sort of out, you know,
dodging buses and taxis,
running with the bulls like we were in Pamplona. But you know, the ambassador, she was great, and we did fine. There's a photo exhibition that I've done called Monumental Motion, because I think that it's not all urban planning, bicycles, traffic, everything. You know what? We're building monuments. I think the greatest monument that Denmark has ever erected, it's not the Little Mermaid, I can tell you that right now. A little green naked woman. You know, it is really the bicycle infrastructure that in Copenhagen. The same applies to Amsterdam and other Dutch and Danish cities. These are monuments to the past, present, but also to the future. Monuments that save lives and, you know, that make cities nicer, you know, providing a large percentage of the population with the chance of riding their bike from A to B. You know, and I try with that exhibition to show the variety of people riding bicycles in Copenhagen. Your men in suits, your fashionistas in their short skirts and heels, your parents on cargo bikes, sort of showing, you know, everything that is possible in a modern, wealthy city like Copenhagen, and what is possible in any city in the world.
That was Michael Colville Anderson, and that brings us to the end of this edition of Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, where, among other things, he sits down with Jeremy Hildreth to discuss how ad campaigns can entice tourists.
Writing is easy until you think about the reader. It's equally true with advertising. It's very easy to write an ad that says what you want it to say. Much harder to create an ad that says something that I want to hear.
And Andrew Muller and Tom Burgess Watson are in the building preparing for Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours at London time. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield, thanks for listening. Goodbye.